Welcome to the Unblocking Crypto Podcast. This podcast is not financial advice. It's meant for entertainment purposes only. These are just the opinions of a couple of rambling wrecks.
Welcome back to Unblocking Crypto, episode number 144. Hal, great to see you again.
Good to be here, Jason. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I just enjoyed Halloween last week. Got all dressed up. I guess the other big news is Bitcoin's white paper turned 16 on Halloween.
That's right.
So it's pretty exciting. I think we approached, what, $100 and something from the all-time high. And what's crazy is it seems like nobody is even aware. Retail has no clue. Oh, I was looking at some stats where the last bull run, the Coinbase app was in the top 50. It's currently at 308, and it jumped 167 positions between the 27th and 28th of October. So one of the interesting things to note is every time Coinbase app hits number one, it usually marks the top of a cycle. So maybe you pay attention to your app store, see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. Nobody's talking to me about Bitcoin. Nobody's, you know, raising it. No, I do not have a friend who is unaware of my Bitcoin position, and nobody's texting me, hey, you know, this and that, nothing. And it's just the way it is, man. I think we have like this buying pressure, that steady heartbeat from ETFs and institutions that keep adding, and corporations that keep adding, and the retail FOMO is not required to keep the price up. I mean, it's, you know, honestly, let's say we're at 70,000. So that's something like we need $32 million per day of fresh money, you know, average coming in to buy up what's being mined. That feels like nothing. That feels like there'll be no problem bringing that money in to maintain the price. And so price fluctuation is really, it just feels like it's that top layer of traders just basically trading with each other up and down. And then meanwhile, the bottom layers of Bitcoin is just getting consumed by guys like me and you and my Christian, the ETF buyers in their 401ks. And yeah, you know, as these institutions keep popping in, then, you know, it's going to be long-term stuff. I read another pension jumped in. You know, this is, to me, pensioners are going to be some of the last guys to get Bitcoin exposure. But a UK pension management company advised a 3% allocation to Bitcoin, and one of their pension customers bought a $60 million position in a pension. So they're not really sellers. You know, this is a 10-year position for them. That's just the way they think. So this, to me, is if you're not paying attention, the math is in the favor of Bitcoin holders.
Well, if you look at BlackRock, they had a $872 million day of inflows, and you just talked about a single day is 34 million or something like that, right? So, but I mean, not only is that amazing, if you think about that, that's more in one day than all but seven of the 590 plus ETFs that were launched in this year, right? That have taken it, and that's more than they've taken in all year, right? So BlackRock just took more in one day than what almost everybody else has taken in more than one year. The other ones that aren't in there are a lot of other Bitcoin ETFs.
Right. I'm telling you, the Bitcoin ETF is a big deal. I think when we first were pontific about the Bitcoin ETFs, like 5 billion in inflows was kind of a low watermark. 10 billion, in my opinion, was something like, okay, we're in good shape. And 15 billion was like this stretch goal jackpot. Everybody's on board. And we're at like 20, something like that.
I think we're over that. Yeah.
We're over 20 billion. We're over 20 billion with another 2 months left. And you know, the guys like Matt Haugen at Bitwise are talking about they're starting to get traction with institutions. I mean, this is, you know, time is in your favor. Like Bitcoin's got that. I don't think that that's real estate that Bitcoin has taken that it will give up. I don't think it'll lose ground in that area that's being taken. So there's that.
You mentioned the UK pensions. So the Florida CFO just came out and said he wants to put part of Florida's pension in Bitcoin. And he mentioned that Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, and Jersey City have already done that, right? So I think they can put up to like 1.5%, something like that, into an investment like that. Currently, they said right now they hold about $800 million in crypto-related investments. So that's things like Coinbase and other accounts, probably MicroStrategy, right? But I mean, that's what state number 4 in the U.S. that is starting to add Bitcoin to their pensions, and it's still only state number 4.
Well, I did read that the state of Michigan released disclosed in their 13F both an ETH ETF and a Bitcoin position. So that might be 5. So you're at 10% of states with public money in pensions having Bitcoin and crypto exposure. That's 10% that's a wrap. It's going to be 100%. It's just a matter of time. Like it's not going to stop. So it's funny, like, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago, we're like, you know, this thing might not work, right? Like there's ways that this thing could just not work. The government stomped, the U.S. government really takes a stand against it. There's a glitch in the system, you know, all the things that were up there. They're going to fork the blockchain, and it's going to get ugly, and which one will win? And man, I'm like, where's the catastrophic risk? Like, I don't see it anymore. So if there's not catastrophic risk to zero, there's only upside from $70,000 per Bitcoin. Like I can't see it any other way anymore.
No, I agree completely, but it's not without the government trying to stop it lately. So I don't know if you saw, but the SEC gave another Wells notice out to Immutable X, which was crazy, is Immutable X got it within the first couple of hours of talking, having their first ever conversation with the SEC. So, and there's very little details of what they're actually investigating. Immutable X is a gaming chain, right? And they think they're going to come after the token that was launched, because now the SEC is going after all the tokens, even though they originally called them securities, and now they're calling them tokens. So not really sure what's going to happen, but they have vowed to fight it along with every other major crypto company in the U.S. that the SEC continues to go after.
Yeah, they're going to figure that out. The guys on the gaming side, the programmers and engineers on the gaming side are smart enough to figure this out so that they can have in-game tokens that can be traded outside of the game on exchanges. Yep. They don't have to be a security. They don't have to be like, it could strictly be play this game, get this token. This token is for sale on this exchange over here. Like there's a way to do this where it's not a security. I know it. I'm not, those guys are smarter than me and they know it. And they know how to do these things. So somebody's going to be like, okay, fine, screw it. I'll figure out what the regulations are. I'll spend 6 months, dive in, and then I'll come out with, here's how we do what we want to do, and we do it legally. You know, it's not going to be the SEC telling them how to do it. It's going to be these guys like, all right, I'll be the expert on regulation. Like nobody's excited to do that, but somebody's going to draw the short straw and figure it out. And then once they figure out the path, gaming crypto stuff will start taking off.
Yeah. And so today is election day in the US, right? So theoretically, at some point in the next couple of months, hopefully we'll know who won once everybody decides who they want to win. But what's interesting is the Coinbase CEO kind of came out and said the SEC has screwed up royally. And he said the next SEC chair really needs to apologize to the American people. And he was urging for regulatory clarity, because even that apology won't undo the damage, but it would really start the process of restoring trust in the SEC, because there almost is zero at this point with the way that they've handled everything. And if you look at like what happened in, I think it was 2018, they originally said digital assets aren't securities. 3 years later, they said they're now investment contracts. And then 3 years after that, they said, oh, they're not securities anymore. Yet they're still coming after like IMX and stuff like this. So then they, back in 2021, I think they talked about the SEC claimed that no regulatory body existed that could handle the exchanges. And a year later, they asserted they had congressional authority to oversee the digital exchanges. So it's kind of funny when you look back over the history of what the SEC has done and even flip-flopping on whether Bitcoin was a commodity or not for a little while, a year or so ago. It's just, man, it doesn't seem like they know what they're doing there, unfortunately.
Now, I think it's pretty bipartisan that the SEC has done a very poor job. And that's one of the only bipartisan topics that I see.
Yeah.
I saw where the SEC has tied up over $500 million in legal fees from crypto.
Mm-hmm.
And the, you know, that's billions of dollars worth of opportunity cost and things like that. You know, when you're distracted, when you've got a small business and a startup and you're distracted with a legal thing, like, that's terrible. Plus, you've got the intimidation factor of what's going on, other companies watching that stuff. It's been a terrible experience for the crypto industry to grow under this SEC because they will just refuse to make decisions. It would be wildly different if all of these crypto companies were just not following the guidance. There's just no guidance. So all of these crypto companies are trying their best, or maybe they aren't trying their best. Maybe they are trying to get away with the most they can get away with, but without guidance, either way is fine. But the SEC is literally just holding this entire industry back for what I can tell is no reason. Like, the United States government is not in the business of choosing which industries go forward and which ones don't. That's not their job. So I don't understand really why the SEC is as against this as it is, other than the politics of Elizabeth Warren and Gary Gensler and whatever power play situation is going on there, because it's a kind of an illogical thing for the SEC to do. I could totally understand if this went on for the first 6 months and the crypto industry kind of hit their head on the ceiling and started becoming real and had to get their stuff together and, okay, we got to figure this out. But we're not a decade into this, but we're getting like close to a decade into the SEC needs to be doing something, and they haven't. So yeah, it would be great to get an apology, but it would be better to just get new people in the SEC.
Well, it was interesting. I think I talked about it last week, was one of these Ripple execs pretty much said, and he hated to come out and say this, but he's like, if I was giving advice to a new crypto company, I would tell them to get outside of the US because it's just too painful right now to try to start a crypto company in the US. And that's what's kind of driving me nuts, is the United States used to be the leader in innovation. And because of what they're doing from a crypto lack of regulation, it's doing the opposite, right? It's driving innovation out of the US, and that's super frustrating. And then so the other thing that just popped up too, the US Treasury came out and said that they think private stablecoins should be replaced by CBDCs.
I don't know. Didn't see that coming.
They said they're worried that the stablecoin industry is buying too many T-bills, which they estimate to be somewhere around $120 billion, which kind of amazes me. I don't know why you would not want somebody to buy T-bills, because the rest of the world is getting away from wanting to buy.
That's what I was going to say. You need a new buyer, guys. Like, you know, buy your own.
Yeah. So I think Tether has like $81 billion of that $120, but they're worried that a stablecoin could go under and create a fire sale for T-bills. And to me, it's almost like the opposite. The U.S. dollar could go under and create a fire sale in the stablecoin that creates some problems at this point. But yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, I know there's been a lot of governors and states that have pushed back on CBDCs. So if the U.S. Treasury actually gets any say in it, in any of this, will be intriguing.
Yeah, if I am the government, I'm not so sure I'm ready to kick off any Treasury buyers. Now, I guess the CBDC would in theory be a buyer of treasuries. I can't imagine a CBDC becoming anything other than the Social Security lockbox. And whatever they do to back the CBDC just gets raided over time. And it, you know what I mean? The government has no history of doing this right. So give me the private, stable coins and whatever privacy I lose because of that is fine. Whatever the government does is going to be significantly worse.
Well, it's funny. I feel like everybody for this election year, no one's really talking about trying to reduce the federal debt. It's all like, oh, we'll give you this money to do this. We're just going to add more to it. Like, yep. We're going away from the opposite of what every other company in the world has to do. So, oh well. There are some pretty interesting announcements from UBS and Franklin Templeton. So UBS announced that they created their first tokenized fund. They built it on Ethereum. It is their USD money market investment fund token called UMINT. And I mean, for those people that aren't aware of UBS, they are one of the largest wealth management companies out there. They handled just under $6 trillion in assets. I think it's like 5.7 last I saw. And then Franklin Templeton, their FOBUX. We've talked about them adding it to Avalanche and Arbitrum and Stellar and Polygon and Aptos. Well, they just added it to Base as well. So now they are the first on one of their kind on Base, which is exciting. And that's Coinbase's L2 on Ethereum.
Yeah, I mean, like, let's go. More stuff, the better. I'm just kind of, when you talk about the SEC and what they're doing, it's almost like, okay, well, let's have as much stuff done as possible and overwhelm.
Yeah. Well, so 21 shares and Canary Capital are, I think, helping with that. 21 shares just became the third firm to submit an S1 for a spot XRP ETF. And then Canary Capital, they filed for a Solana ETF. They're also the third company to do that. I think VanEck and 21 shares had already done that too. So, I mean, XRP and Solana are now kind of tied as far as next tokens that people want to create an ETF for. We'll see what really happens, but I mean, it's kind of to your point, just keep throwing shit at the SEC, get them to look at something.
And I mean, and if you're paying attention, it's like, well, crap, if I can get an ETF for my token, a lot of the heat comes off.
yeah exactly. It becomes a commodity at that point. Exactly. So we talked about Stripe buying Bridge. Well, that was, I mean, that hasn't gone through yet, but while this whole acquisition is happening for over $1 billion, Bridge just acquired Triangle. So Triangle is a Web3 wallet infrastructure platform that their whole concept is they offer APIs that allow companies to offer wallets to less tech-savvy users. So kind of going back to where I think we've talked about this in a while is crypto is hard for a lot of people to understand. And if you can make it simple for people that deal with the regular Web2 stuff every day, then that would be ideal. So I'm intrigued to see what this does and if it creates more users to get on board. I think Triangle actually was an ex-Bridge employee that went out and started his own company, and they brought him back in. But yeah, it's exciting news to hear that we're seeing some acquisitions happening again in the crypto space too.
I agree. I think that is a little bit of signal there that big money's being spent positioning ahead of, you know, some moves.
So some world news that I saw that was interesting. We talked last week about Tigran actually being released from Nigeria. Well, Biden just credited Nigerian president's leadership as being crucial to getting him released, which kind of makes me raise an eyebrow, because you're like, wait a minute, he's been in there for 8 months. That it was nothing that was his fault. You blamed it on the company, and he's saying his leadership is great. That was kind of interesting to see. They also saw the Nigeria's dollar, the Naira, is down 43% year to date against the US dollar. So one of the reasons there, I think they're fighting so hard against crypto is they're just struggling to stay afloat. I think I even saw there was 29 teenagers or something like that that are possibly going to get the death penalty over there for protesting against the cost of living increases and stuff like that. So they got a whole world of stuff going on over there. That's one of those places where it's like, okay, Nigeria is not on my list anytime soon to go visit at this point.
Yeah, that's not great, Bob. You can't jail teenagers for protesting and get a lot of credit in, like, from the West. when you're losing to the dollar by 50% and the dollar has lost to goods and services by 50% in the last three years or so, you're in trouble. Like your people are like looking at this local currency, like this stuff is garbage. And, you know, on a smaller scale, you know, I was listening to some political economic evaluation or something about the strength of the American consumer. The American consumer was resilient. It's still spending, right? Because that's kind of an indicator for a recession, is when the American consumer breaks and stops spending money, and then the economy starts to decline, and then you get into a recession. And I'm like, man, the American consumer has two options. The American consumer can, one, spend their money today or finance things so that they can appear to be wealthy or appear to have money and keep up with the Joneses like America's used to, and, you know, go into debt, credit card debt, to buy everyday items and things like that. And honestly, that's the lifestyle that the majority of Americans are tricked into wanting. Or they can save their dollars. They can live modestly and save dollars. And now they've got a problem of these dollars are falling apart. I want to buy a new house. The down payment was $40,000. I got to $40,000. It took me 3 years. Now the down payment's $55,000. And so they're now forced to be investors in order to just keep up with inflation. They got to actually kind of kill it. And so that's the American consumer's position. Hey man, do you want another part-time job as a financial advisor for yourself to figure out what you want to invest in and risk your money? Because everybody talks about risk so that people can be scared into paying somebody 1% to handle their money. Or do you want to just have some cooler, nicer things and just not have as much money in your bank account? I'm like, guess which one they pick. So like, yeah, the American consumer is going to be resilient all the way down until they're bankrupt. So, you know, inflation sucks. Inflation is really, like, I've never gotten into it. You know, I was born in 1981. So my lifetime, inflation has been bouncing between like 1 and 2.5%. Like, I've never felt inflation. But the last 4 years, man, it's crazy how bad inflation is for people. And so, yeah, if you weren't above a certain point when your net worth in 2020, you are really falling behind. And if you're really falling behind, there's a family that I'm aware of that's close to me that put in a pool, but it's very well known that they get help from their family to pay for their mortgage. And so we're sitting around talking. And so I grew up in a single mom house with no money and everything. And my mom was like, well, hey guys, do you want to be poor or do you want to be poor with a pool? Like, which one sounds better to you? And she's like, when you don't have any money and you have an opportunity to do something fun, you kind of take it, because what's the difference between being poor and being a bit poorer, or being in debt and a little bit more in debt? Wow. And, you know, once you're, and I was young when we were in that position. We kind of moved into middle class when I was more of an adolescent teenager. But I'm like, yeah, I can totally see how you're like, oh, we can make this pool work. We can get it installed and they won't repossess it. And like, you know, build a deck around it and da 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 da. And I'm like, yeah, I could totally see how it would be like, screw it, we're everything sucks anyway. Let's just make it a little bit cool. Like, let's have something kind of cool. So yeah, that's the American consumer. Like, they get to choose between spending money and being and not having wealth, or not spending money and not having wealth. Guess which one they're going to choose. So that was kind of just some shower thoughts this week for me. Was like, man, yeah, the American consumer is going to be resilient all the way down
until they can't be anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, government's flip flopping. Russia is back in the news too. They just created some new crypto laws. So they had recently just allowed crypto mining. Now they're banning crypto mining in some areas. They legalized it, what, back in August, and it's now November. So that did not take very long at all. And I guess the good news is, at the same time, they are now allowing their citizens to trade crypto. So they had legalized it for international settlements, but now they're giving their citizens access to it. So I guess there's some positive news there, but it's kind of going back and forth. They don't know what they're doing, and it seems like governments are just flapping in the wind a lot of times.
Yeah, man. If you don't take this seriously, then you just you're a rudderless sailboat, you know. And then if the winds start to blow you towards allowing Bitcoin, you allow it. And then when the winds blow you the other way, you ban it. You need to put a rudder down, and that requires doing some research and having people to get serious and all of those things. So until governments decide to do that, they flip flop back and forth. And I don't have a lot of confidence in governments, but it'll happen. It has to happen because Bitcoin's not going to go away. Bitcoin's all rudder. Bitcoin doesn't have sails. Bitcoin just goes directly forward. So, you know, that's the whole point of it. It's, you can't screw with it. It's not going to veer left or right. You know, it's going. So, you know, the wind's going to blow you around like crazy. The wind isn't changing Bitcoin at all.
So if Bitcoin's all rudder, maybe the only sail that they do have out there is probably MicroStrategy. And MicroStrategy's just unveiled a new plan to raise $42 billion over the next 3 years to buy more Bitcoin. So, which is kind of crazy by itself, but if you break it down to the numbers, that's over $1 billion a month, which we talked about, 450 Bitcoin a day being mined, which means that today's prices, a month's worth of Bitcoin is around $1 billion. So in essence, what MicroStrategy is about to say is they want to buy the monthly supply of Bitcoin for the next 3 years. Now, of course, it's going to go up, and it's not going to be exactly like that, right? But I mean, talk about just a tailwind all of a sudden for Bitcoin that is crazy to me, that you have MicroStrategy that's saying, we're about to buy a ton of it. Either get on board or get out of the way.
Hey, I actually listened to that earnings call because I've just gotten to where if I can listen to the long form version, I do, because the clips just don't do it for me anymore. And man, I couldn't sleep afterward, man. It's very exciting to have that much gumption and that much conviction to say, well, here's what we're going to do. Here's what we're going to do. Go ahead and beat us to it if you want.
Yeah.
Like, we're still going to spend our $42 billion, or we're going to raise our $42 billion and buy Bitcoin with it. It's up to the market to decide how much Bitcoin MicroStrategy is able to buy. If they don't buy much, then MicroStrategy is going to get more. And if they start buying, then the price goes up and MicroStrategy doesn't get as much. Bold move, right? I mean, most of these purchases are announced after the purchases are made, because you don't want the market to mess with you. But I, you know, when I heard that, I was like, $42 billion, man, holy crap. That's, you know, it's a lot. MicroStrategy, I don't remember the numbers, but I feel like their Bitcoin holdings are worth something like $18 billion right now. And they're in about $8 billion in debt to be there. Those numbers aren't right, but they're something close. So $42 billion over the $18 billion that they already have isn't bad. But they're only in $8 billion worth of debt. So if he's right, right, let's just assume he's right, that he's buying Bitcoin, and at the end of this 3 years, the price is significantly elevated, and he's like a 2 or 3Xer on his 42. You know, you're talking about bumping your head on $200,000 Bitcoin as the expectation here. You know, Bitcoin's not going to be $70,000 3 years from now. If it is, I can't imagine. That Bitcoin being flat for 3 years is more bullish to me than Bitcoin going to zero when I was thinking about it 7 years ago. It doesn't make sense that Bitcoin, even if it goes all the way up and all the way down, Bitcoin cycles, blah, 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 for it to come down to $70,000 3 years from now would be the most bearish case for Bitcoin that I can conceive. So, dude, Bitcoin, or Michael Saylor, gets it deeper than I do, and he's got amazing levers to pull. But if you're not paying attention to this, these are real numbers. Like, these, you know, this isn't his initial $500 million purchase with his cash reserve. You know, this is 80x his initial move into the market when the price was 7x lower than it is today. Like, we've talked about it before, but not often, that Bitcoin's attractiveness to purchase increases as the price goes up, right? More money is available to Bitcoin as the market cap increases. And so the earlier you get in, the better. And like, it's still really early. I mean, in the next 3 years, you're still going to have institutions waffling about whether they're going to get 1-3% exposure. So this is super early. Anyway, man, I listened to that earnings call. I don't usually do that, but it was as good as any of Michael Saylor's speeches at a Bitcoin conference.
Yeah, he is. I mean, I don't know if there's a bigger bull out there. I mean, I know we talk about Larry Fink being a pretty big bull of Bitcoin too, but there's nobody out there doing what Michael Saylor is doing and talking about, for sure, right? So
everything's on the line for Michael Saylor. Like, if Bitcoin fails, like if there's some scenario, black swan thing where Bitcoin fails, no one crashes harder than Michael Saylor.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the vision for MicroStrategy, from what I understand, is almost like this Bitcoin bank in the future, a $1 trillion Bitcoin bank that is going to enable all types of different financial transactions and be that central location. But for Michael Saylor too, a lot of what he doesn't have kids, he doesn't have family. So pretty much what he said is that when he's dead, all of his Bitcoin is getting left to the world to make it a better place. So it's not like this is a trying to take over the world type thing, and which I guess Bitcoin theoretically kind of is, but he's trying to make the world a better place, which to me is kind of awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I listened to Michael Saylor talk probably as much as anybody. Like every human, he's not going to say 100% of things that I agree with completely. I'm aware of when he says things that I don't understand. I know sometimes it's not that I don't agree with what he says. Sometimes he just steps into this abstract world of digital real estate and kind of goes off on a riff that I don't walk that entire walk with him when he's talking about it. But in the aggregate, Michael Saylor is something different for crypto. Like, there's not going to be another guy like him. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, it's so much easier to be the second guy than the first. And he's acting like the 10th guy that has all the confidence from the other guys that barely put their foot in and did. But, and so they go in, you know, leveraged in conviction and all this stuff. He went from nowhere to like a real fanatic, man. And I listened to a lot of these MicroStrategy stock evaluation guys talk. I don't know if that's on your radar, but Twitter's got a few guys that are like quant investors that are just at this point, they're only focused on MicroStrategy. Their entire portfolio is MicroStrategy or MicroStrategy leveraged ETFs. There's nothing other than MicroStrategy to these guys. And all they do every week, they have a Monday MicroStrategy call and talk about quant stuff that is the most boring. I listen to boring things a lot. It's the worst of the most boring things. And they can't get enough of MicroStrategy and how it's going to explode, like, and with the leverage play on Bitcoin and Bitcoin's tendency to do what it is. Looks like it's going to do, and go price looks like it's going to go up, and it's, you know, it'll be in the headlines a lot. And I think that's when you start to see Bitcoin run, is when Bitcoin gets in the headlines. And if MicroStrategy is the first prairie dog to pop out of the ground and get some headlines for Bitcoin on this run, then that's a very different thing than, oh, look at all these nerds getting rich on Bitcoin in their computers, and they have to do all these hard things to get on there. It's like, wait, I can just buy the stock and get into Bitcoin
and get a better return than Bitcoin.
Yeah, or you call your broker and they're like, you know, I can't get into MicroStrategy, but hey, look, I'll transfer some funds to your Schwab account, buy some Bitcoin ETF, or buy some MicroStrategy. You know what I mean? Like, once somebody decides they want to buy it, get in, like, their broker kind of has to help them do it. So. Yeah, man, it's remarkable what they're doing at MicroStrategy, and I'm here to watch. I bought enough MicroStrategy stock so that I can do some covered calls and play with it. But the more I listen to these quant guys talk, the more I'm like, I don't want to sell a call option way out of the money. And then it actually hit because MicroStrategy just took off and tripled in a month.
Yeah, no, that's definitely possible for sure. So we've been talking a lot about Bitcoin, but I do want to mention Ethereum too. So if you look at Ethereum's transactions, it's been pretty eye-opening. So the L2s on Ethereum are transacting more than 20 million transactions per day. So they're up over 4x year to date and more than 20x since the start of 2023. So, I mean, Bitcoin's great. Don't get me wrong. There's still a lot outside of Bitcoin too. Yeah, even though everybody's talking about Solana being the next great smart contract platform, there is so much stuff still happening on Ethereum, and they're getting faster and cheaper too. So it's exciting to see, and just wanted to make sure others were aware of that too.
Yeah, I mean, the Ethereum price versus what is going on in Ethereum aren't always very well connected. So, you know, I'm just here to watch on the Ethereum stuff. I'm holding my position, and I just view it as like, you know, I bought this stuff when I bought some Bitcoin, so I'm just gonna I'm not motivated to sell it and turn it into Bitcoin for some reason. Like my investment thesis at the time was one of these Bitcoins is gonna win, so I'll buy Litecoin, Ethereum, and Bitcoin. And so it's hard once I have my initial thesis, it's tough to be like, all right, it's time to drop out of one and get another. So I'm just sitting on Ethereum. I like to watch it. The Ethereum ecosystem in itself would keep you busy on a podcast. I mean, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, no, there's a ton. So I think the exciting part is it's still growing, right? And I think that's kind of the main message to leave everybody with. I did see some other interesting news. Visa just partnered with Coinbase, and the goal is to offer instant deposit services for customers using eligible debit cards. So I don't think this is like a brand new thing, because I feel like other places have had it, but for Visa to make some big announcements in the crypto, that's becoming more and more important. I know MasterCard has done a lot of this in the future, and I feel like Visa is trying to play catch up. So Visa and Coinbase are two very large names these days, and it's good to see those two working together.
Yeah, I'll take Visa on team crypto. They are ripe to be disrupted, so they should be motivated to figure this out pretty quickly. So yeah, good for Visa.
Exactly. So Binance was in the news. I know CZ just got out of jail, and I've watched a little bit of him talking about his experience in jail, where all the guards were asking him what to invest in. He said, I don't actually have the access to the internet, so I don't really think I should tell you. But so Binance is launching what they call Binance Wealth, and it's mainly in Asia and Latin America to start. It's not really planned in the U.S. because the U.S. and Binance don't really get along. But the whole goal of this is they're going to offer white glove service for high net worth clients. And they do everything from like even creating sub accounts for you that you can go track and on a proof of reserves page so that you can see that your crypto is in that space. So, I mean, I know that's been kind of a big issue in the past, is if it's an exchange, it's not your keys. And while it's not ideal, I think for a lot of people that don't understand it, don't have the time, they don't want to have to deal with their keys. So for Binance to do something like this, I think it's kind of cool. I still think Binance is probably one of the better exchanges out there, even though they've been drugged through the mud by the U.S. government, but they were kind of the OG, and they've done a lot of good things in this space.
I think they're still the biggest. So, you know, you can't ignore Binance.
Yeah. In addition to that, there's another company out there that I feel like is trying to do something similar. Nexo, which I don't know if you remember them or not, but they were one of the ones that kind of got hit with some of the bankruptcy issues. So they're rebranding themselves to a digital assets wealth platform. So they no longer operate in the U.S., shocker, right? Nor do they claim to be a wealth management platform. They're just a digital assets wealth platform. So it's kind of interesting what they're doing. And they're having this new sleek look that apparently people are going to want to go use. And I think so many people have probably gotten burnt by Nexo that I'm not sure why they're going to go back, but I guess good for them for trying.
Yeah. I mean, once these guys pivot, like pivoting is good when whatever you're doing is not working the way you want it to. Time to shift.
And then I'm not sure if you saw the British Asian macroeconomist that came out and said he was Satoshi, although he's been saying that for a couple of years on his Twitter page kind of thing. So Stephen Mola, he came out and showed why he was Satoshi and showed some screen edits that everybody's like, that's super easy to decipher. He said, well, I'll transfer some of the original Bitcoins from Satoshi's wallet at some point soon. You just guys wait, but we're going to make a big spectacle of it. And everybody that looked at it was like, no, there's no way this guy is Satoshi. So there's not a single person in crypto that is really believing him, but he is still trying to get his 5 minutes of limelight.
Go for it, dude.
Yeah. We've talked a little bit about World Liberty in the past. I know they struggled to hit their funding goal. They had like, what, $1.5 billion valuation, and they wanted to raise $300 million. Well, that's been cut 90% to $30 million. Because I don't know if they get the funds until they hit their funding goal. And they're, I think as of a week or two ago, they were at like $14 million. So they still got a long ways to go. So we'll see what actually happens with this, but it is still undergoing, I guess.
That's a good sign, man. The less that these altcoin scammy things get off the ground, the better.
Yep. And then Tornado Cash's founder, Roman Storm, his trial just got delayed until, I think, April 14th of next year. So this is still one of those things where it'll be interesting to see if software code is considered free speech or not. But it would be good to get that taken care of. Maybe by this time in April, it'll be a new SEC. Well, hopefully, fingers crossed, that will have happened.
Hopefully.
And then the last thing that I had was just in the RWA space. Securitize just passed $1 billion in tokenized on-chain assets. So they had about $500 million, I think, in July. So some pretty decent growth happening over, what, less than 4 months. They're almost doubling. So RWAs, they're still happening out there. Well, nobody's really talking about them, but it's coming. The wave is coming.
I mean, we've even only dedicated 1 or 2% of this podcast to them. Yeah. but like, you know, we talk about gaming. I'm pretty big on gaming. I should probably be bigger on real-world assets. It seems like as the use cases go, they're getting better at figuring that stuff out, and they seem to be more serious about figuring out how to do it, like, legally. And Larry Fink's on board, so that helps. You know, it seems like once he gets on board with something, then, like, the legal side just starts to work in your favor.
Well, it's like BlackRock and Franklin Templeton are leading the space here, right? Just like, okay, for those guys to be leading, I mean, that's kind of scary at the same time, right? It's, they're not the innovators typically. It's somebody else innovating, and they're, I guess, turning to a fast follower.
Yeah, I mean, well, those guys know how to grease the rails so that, you know, they can lay them down quick and travel quick. So, like, real world assets, I should probably be more interested in that and more bullish about it. But it's like, you know, then I'm not listening to Bitcoin stuff. So a couple of things for me to wrap things up, man. Number one was, you know, we talked a lot about Metaplanet, or we talked a lot about MicroStrategy and their Bitcoin strategic plan and everything they're doing. Metaplanet is that Japanese company that Dylan LeClaire jumped on board with, and they're basically duplicating the same playbook from MicroStrategy, but they're doing it in Japan and it's working and they're doing all those things. But the thing that I like, because it's so easy to understand, is they just got picked up and added to an ETF, CoinShares Blockchain Global Equity Index. It's BLOCK is the ticker symbol, right? I mean, it's a $2.4 billion market cap ETF, so it's not nothing. But the point is, once you add Bitcoin to your balance sheet, it opens some doors to hack the TradFi rails, because once you get added to an ETF, you're not dropping off. And that's just money that flows into you that from people that aren't trying to buy your stock, you know? So, you know, once some of these businesses realize, like, hey, what can we do to get on the most ETFs? And then, okay, well, maybe not the most ETFs, but what ETFs are bringing in the most money? And, you know, yeah, okay, we're not going to get into the Qs, and we're not going to get into the S&P 500, but, man, we can get into this niche over here that nobody's really touching, and it's growing. And so I wouldn't be surprised if more people more companies don't get into the Bitcoin side just to open up more avenues for funds to flow in for their stock price.
Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense.
And the final thing I have is I listened to a podcast with Howard Lutnick on Pomp. Howard Lutnick's the CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald. He spoke at the Bitcoin conference this year. He's the guy that said he had a shit ton of Bitcoin. And
hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yes. And so Pomp had him on, you know, so he's a part of the Trump transition team. So the political stuff, you know, whatever. I like to have Bitcoin people on, you know, in these circles. But, you know, he told the story of him growing up. He lost with his parents when he was like when he first started college. And he and his sister raised his brother, and they did all, you know, they all kind of came together. The rest of the family kind of left him alone because they were afraid that they would want to move in with him and stuff like that. So it was like a 20-year-old, an 18-year-old, and a 15-year-old orphans, you know, near adult orphans making it work. And so he told the whole story and everything. And, you know, I knew in the 9/11 story, his brother has died, but I was like, dude, when you hear that story from in 30 minutes, go from, you know, if we raised my brother to my brother was in the building when it collapsed and he died. And then, you know, this guy, Howard Lutnick, is not your typical billionaire, I guess, is what I'm trying to get across. He has so much empathy and sympathy for people that most billionaires don't have, because you usually don't become a billionaire by caring about people, you know? And so he told this very emotional story, this roller coaster story. And Pomp bailed him out at the end and was like, how much Bitcoin do you have? And he you know, he didn't really want to say, but he, you know, he's like hundreds of millions. Like it's a lot. But I mean, you know, you talk about kind of the difference between hearing about billionaires suck, and then you listen to a guy tell a story and you're like, oh, this dude's as human as anybody. You know, it's pretty eye opening. And you know, Cantor Fitzgerald, it's not like he has it the say and the, but he has a ton of influence over that gigantic company. And so, you know, things like that are very favorable for Bitcoin. So I would just, it would be a recommended podcast if you're looking for something that's Bitcoin related, but also like a good, like backstory kind of thing. And to understand who this guy is, you're probably going to hear his name. If it depends on what happens today, if, you know, if the red team does actually win, you're going to hear about him. So you might as well get to know him a little bit. And that podcast, you know, it wasn't a normal let's talk numbers podcast. It was a much more of a touchy feely one. So, you know, I like podcasts because you do actually get past the layers of sales pitchy comments and things. You get into like a real conversation. And so that I think that was probably one of the better ones I've listened to in general. So I'll put a plug in for that.
Awesome. I'll have to go take a listen. Listen to that. I did see some of the highlights of that, but I didn't see the hear about the story. So that'll be cool to listen to. Cool.
That's all I got.
Awesome. Well, Hal, great to see you again. Great talking with you. Let's talk again next week.
Sounds good, man. Thanks a lot.
If all of these crypto conversations leave you with more questions and you're looking for answers, I've created a product that dives into most of those answers, including why crypto, how to set up a cold wallet, and some of the more advanced strategies for dealing with crypto. Check the link in the notes below and hope to see you there.